This morning's topic is Solomon. Didn't know what to call this one for sure, but we're really going to talk a lot more about his idolatry and his wisdom in that. We're going to talk a lot about both sides of it. But it's sad that what he ends up being known for so much, and the reason that he was even kind of failed as a king is through his idolatry ultimately. The Bible talks about the kind of love we're supposed to have for God, and it goes all the way back to the books of Moses. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and 5, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." So this was God's command. This was his ideal that he set up right from the beginning with the nation of Israel. You shall love him supremely. Somebody tell me, what is the first commandment? Well, that is true. That is Jesus' summary of all of the commandments. He says, if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and if you love your neighbor as yourself, you will actually fulfill all the law, which is just amazing to think about that it can be boiled down that simply. The first of the Ten Commandments, I think you were saying it there, is you shall have no other gods before me. Keep God first place. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Well, God gives that as the first commandment, as the priority, and we fail so often in this command. I'm going to take you to the New Testament, and before I take you there to Ephesians 5, also Colossians 3, there are two verses that really explain where idolatry is rooted in our hearts today, because we're not bowing down to statues. But there is one word that really links, really explains, clarifies idolatry. Before I turn to this passage, does anyone know what that word is? Starts with a C. That's the right word, yeah. Coveting. So listen to what Paul says. This is right from Paul. He explains it so clearly. Ephesians 5:5, "For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God." No idolater, no covetous man. That's interesting. That helps us. I had a man come up to me one time. I preached somewhere. It was before I moved here. And a man came up and says, we were talking about idolatry, I suppose. And he said, Well, what really is the essence of idolatry? And this is the verse I took him to. I say, well, it's really explained by Paul right here. And that makes sense, because in our nation, in our culture, North America, it's maybe hard for us to grasp idolatry. We're not amongst the statue worshiping pagans, if you will. But we are amongst idolaters, that's for sure. And Colossians 3:5 essentially says the very same thing in a little bit different way. He says, "Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry." Same idea. Greed, covetousness, same idea. So that's Paul's clarification on the issue. We're all able to comprehend and understand that, oh, wow, that is something that I'm guilty of, at least from time to time, at least sometimes. And then I want to take you to 1 Thessalonians 1 and notice what God says about them. Paul is writing here. He says, "For they," that's other people around, "for they themselves report about us what kind of a reception we had with you and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God." This is what should be happening all the time. People get saved, they turn from their idolatry to God. Sadly, many Christians keep on drifting from the true God back to idolatry. So we can all be guilty, right? And here's what we're going to talk about with Solomon is he started well. Solomon's wisdom. Solomon started so well. He became king of Israel, and he was known very soon for his wisdom and godly example. But the end of David's life here, we're going to read some instructions. 1 Chronicles 28. This is David passing the throne, passing the crown to Solomon. He says, "As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father." Well, that is good advice. "And serve him with a whole heart and a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will let you find him. But if you forsake him, he will reject you forever. Consider now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be courageous and act." Great words, words of wisdom. Personally, when I read through the Proverbs, which are written by Solomon, I often think to myself, I wonder how many of these his father taught him, right? I wonder how many of these things were from David. I really believe a good amount of what, not all of it for sure, but I believe there's a significant portion of the Proverbs. I believe that's probably wisdom his dad taught him. David was certainly a godly man, and he had wisdom. Read the Psalms. Now let's go to 1 Kings, though. And if you have your Bible, we're going to read from 1 Kings chapter 2. I don't have these on the slide, so we're going to have to turn there. 1 Kings is really the beginning of Solomon's reign, and it goes well into the book, about half of the book or so. It's about Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 2, let's begin at verse 1. "As David's time to die drew near, he charged Solomon his son, saying, 'I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn, so that the Lord may carry out his promise which he spoke concerning me, saying, If your sons are careful of their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel.'" Great promise. Notice too, I just want to point you back to verse 2, and it says, "Be strong therefore and show yourself a man." Now what, right away, what can you tell me? What is a man then? What does he say? What does he go on to say? What makes a man a strong man? Pretty much most of our culture thinks that it's muscle size, right? Height, stature, muscle size, athletic ability. The more muscle, the faster, the better you can hit that hard piece of plastic, the more accurate you can throw a ball, the more of a man you are. Okay. Yeah. Right, yeah. So know the Lord, right? Walk in the ways of the Lord. Keep his law, keep his commandments. That's a man, someone who can know the Lord and follow him and set that example to others. It's a real man is someone who's got that kind of spiritual strength, not physical strength. All right. We're going to turn to 1 Kings 3, and I do have these verses up here on several slides. A lengthy portion, but let's read these verses starting in verse 5 of 1 Kings 3. "In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, 'Ask what you wish me to give you.' Then Solomon said, 'You have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, according as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward you. And you have reserved for him this great loving kindness, that you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. Your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people, which are too many to be numbered or counted. So give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? Wow, just think about basically a blank check, right? God says, what do you want, Solomon? Ask me and I'll give it to you. Wow. And Solomon is just an amazing example here. What he asks for. It was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked for this thing. God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself discernment to understand justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, nor shall one like you arise after you. I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you all your days. In you, if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and commandments as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. Well, we haven't maybe been given that blank check, so to speak, as God gave to Solomon in those words. But there is a New Testament verse that shows us that we are supremely blessed. God has given us a lot, or promised the availability of a lot of blessing. Can anyone think of a verse that tells about that? God giving us these things that maybe we haven't even asked for? Okay, well, that's true about wisdom. God promises us in James, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. So we are given a promise of wisdom to those who ask. Okay. Well, okay. Yeah. That's in Ephesians, I believe. I think it's Ephesians 1. And that's similar to the one I'm going to go to. Very similar idea. Matthew 6:33. It says, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. The promise here, I hope we can grasp this, is if we would put God first, the same thing that Solomon was to do, the same thing David told him, the same thing God told him. Follow me. Put me first. If you would do that, your life will be blessed beyond measure. Seek me first. Seek God first. Put God first in your life. All these things will be added to you. You won't have a miserable, empty life. It'll be a very full, rich, rewarded life. Promise to all believers. All right, we're going to turn now to, same chapter, 1 Kings. Where were we just in? I want to go to chapter 3. So in chapter 3, we're going to look at about Solomon here. Chapter 3, popular story, a humorous, sad and humorous story at the same time, perhaps. Starting at verse 16. Then two women, who were harlots, came to the king and stood before him. The one woman said, oh, my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. It happened on the third day after I gave birth that this woman also gave birth to a child, and we were together. There was no stranger with us in the house, only the two of us in the house. This woman's son died in the night because she lay on it. So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from beside me, while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead son in my bosom. When I rose in the morning to nurse my son, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him carefully in the morning, behold, he was not my son whom I had born. Then the other woman said, no, for the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. But the first woman said, no, for the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. Then the king said, the one says, this is my son who is living, and your son is the dead one. And the other says, no, for your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one. The king said, give me a sword. So they brought a sword before the king. The king said, divide the living child in two, and give half to the one and half to the other. Then the woman whose child was the living one spoke to the king, for she was deeply stirred over her son, and said, oh, my lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him. But the other said, he shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide him. Can you just imagine Then the king said, give the first woman the living child, and by no means kill him. She is his mother. When all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. This is just a fascinating story to demonstrate, and I wonder how many of those there were. I think, you know, the author picks one just to kind of show this is what really set the stage for his wisdom to be known and magnified through the land. But I wonder how many of those kinds of situations he had to deal with, and wouldn't you have loved to have been around just to see how Solomon administered justice? Wouldn't that have been a delight and a joy to watch, as opposed to what we get to watch day in and day out on the news? Such a lack of justice and a lack of any common sense or wisdom at all. But can you imagine living in a land ruled by a man like that? Wouldn't that be a treat? Wouldn't that be a land of justice and joy, to have a wise ruler like that? Well, that's Solomon's beginning there in wisdom. Let's turn to chapter 4, and we're just going to highlight some other aspects of his riches and his kingdom. So in chapter 4, just kind of skip with me through some verses. Verse 21. Now Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Verse 24 now. Drop down. For he had dominion over everything west of the river, from Tiphshah even to Gaza, over all the kings west of the river, and he had peace on all sides around about him. And verse 26. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. I've been around a few farms, never seen one quite that large, that many stalls, 40,000 stalls. Just to show, they're just really showing the extent of his kingdom, his armies, and so forth. Verse 29, now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind, like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. And that's a significant statement. They're making a point here. Wisdom surpassing all the wisdom of the Egyptians even. And you know, the Egyptians were known for some of their incredible feats of architecture and engineering. And it says Solomon's wisdom surpassed them all. In other words, God gave him wisdom in virtually every field. Can you imagine? Can you imagine just to have that amount of wisdom? You know, people go to school these days, after they finish high school, they go and they train. And it's common for people to go to a university and get a four-year degree or a master's degree or advanced degree in one field. Sometimes people will branch out and take a dual major and go into two fields. And so you might have somebody that has a degree in this and a degree in that. Sometimes. But not many. But this man God just gave him knowledge in all sorts of things. And we're going to read a little bit more about it. Let's drop down now to verse 32. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. Again, we might study it and really get to understand some things about a few of those things. He knew about them all. And it's like he didn't have to have somebody teach him those things. He just got that from God. Fascinating. Verse 34. Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. This was a man who was known far and wide. Now I'm going to ask us to turn all the way to chapter 10. And we're going to read a few verses there. Then I do have some more slides we'll put up in a moment. But let's just read here about his visit from the Queen of Sheba. I love this account. This, to me, really encapsulates the extent of Solomon's wisdom. If you doubted it, well, this is another person's testimony here. Chapter 10, verse 1. Now, when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon, it's already been spreading around the world, concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with difficult questions. So she came to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels carrying spices and very much gold and precious stones. When she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. In other words, she was testing him with all of these different questions, probably deep philosophical questions, questions that she couldn't get answers to from other people. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king, which he did not explain to her. When the queen of Sheba perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his servants, the attendance of his waiters and their attire, his cupbearers and his stairway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. In other words, it was amazing even to notice the administration that he had. He had wisdom, and he had all that stuff planned out. So everything just happened in an orderly sequence. He had all these servants that did all the work, all the cooking, all the preparing food, and all the specialized seating. Everything was so meticulously planned out that you could just tell by looking at it, wow, this guy is on top of things. This guy is also an administrator above all else that could administrate. And so she was, it says here, there was no more spirit in her. It blew her away. Okay, that's the common paraphrase. It blew her away. And it goes on to say how much. Then she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I did not believe the reports." In other words, what she was hearing was sounded so far-fetched. Okay, she heard about Solomon and she couldn't believe it. She goes, "There's no way anybody is that wise." And so, well, I'll go check it out. And she continued on, "Nevertheless, I did not believe the reports until I came and my eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. You exceed in wisdom and prosperity the report which I heard. How blessed are your men. How blessed are these your servants who stand before you continually and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God who delighted in you to set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness." Just a lot in that statement. We really can't even grasp perhaps how much is being stated by that. This was somebody who had been around, somebody who knew what she was talking about, and said, "Wow, even what I heard, I thought that was far-fetched, and it's not even half of it." Solomon was unequaled, unparalleled. His kingdom was unparalleled over the entire world. That's the kind of man that God had made him. 1 Kings chapter 10, still I'm going to put up a few verses here. "All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forests of Lebanon were of pure gold." I love this statement. "None was of silver. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon." Pure gold. Pure gold. I wonder, you know, just can you imagine that, right? You'd be afraid to even go anywhere in there. Touch anything. Keep on going a couple more verses here. "So King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. All the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem, and he made cedars as plentiful as sycamore trees that are in the lowland." Unparalleled. All right. So, and by the way, it's no mistake. It's no, right? It's not by accident that Jesus, when he was trying to compare the glory of God's creation to something, he compared it to Solomon. Not even Solomon in all his glory was as beautiful as what, you know, and he's comparing it to something God did, God's kingdom. And he uses Solomon because that was the unsurpassed picture of glory that men would know. All right, but there was a problem here. So 1 Kings 9:6-9, "But if you," God gives this warning, "but if you or your sons indeed turn away from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and the house which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss and say, 'Why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house?' And they will say, 'Because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and adopted other gods and worshipped them and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all this adversity on them.'" All right, that's kind of the setup here for our second and last point this morning. We have Solomon's wisdom. Now we're going to look at Solomon's folly. Solomon's folly, his downfall. It's interesting that toward the end of his life, if that is when he wrote Ecclesiastes, somewhere, middle toward end, I'm guessing. He said, indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. Those are Solomon's own words. And he too fell into sin. And chapter 11 is the chapter that begins his downfall description. We've been reading up through chapters 9 and 10. Well, here's chapter 11, first verse. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. That's Solomon's problem. The problem with that, there was more than one problem. Just very quickly, what were the problems with Solomon loving many foreign women? Yes, they turned his heart away from the Lord. And what's the other problem? Yeah, it's just that word many. God said, you shall not have multiple wives. Okay, so let's look at some of these passages right from the law again, from Deuteronomy chapter 7. God said, furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. By the way, he's talking about all the foreigners around them when they go into the land. Verse 4, notice this phrase, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. God said, they will turn your sons away from following me. Well, Solomon didn't just go, you know, one or two. By the way, well, we got to be careful too. This is just a true fact of life, where we sin, or where what we do a little bit, typically our children after us will do a lot, right? If we say it's okay to do a little here, then typically our children are going to justify doing even more than we did. That's just a truism of life, is it not? Right? Well, David had multiple wives. We talked about that when we talked about David a while back. Remember we had on the list there were at least eight. I kept right number of fingers up here. There were at least eight that are named that we know of. We think that's a lot. It is a lot. Well, Solomon went way above and beyond that. 1 Kings 11 again, verse 3, he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned his heart away. Deuteronomy 7, again, back to Deuteronomy, but a different verse here. It says, this is specifically, this verse, when God gives this verse, he is specifically talking now about, when the day comes that you want a king, then you shall take a king from among your people, you shall do this and this, and God gives them instructions. When the day comes that you ask for a king for yourself, okay, you can have one. But he gives this explicit, very specific command. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. Do you think God maybe knows a little something about human nature? You know, I think we ought to just trust God when he gives us these warnings, obey God when he gives us commands. God understands human nature. God knows our heart. In fact, God knows our heart better than we do. What does the Bible say about your heart? It is deceitfully wicked, right? Jeremiah 17:9. It is deceitful above all things. And it says, who can know it? In other words, you can't. What does the next verse say? I, the Lord, search the heart. God alone knows the depth of the depravity of the human heart. God alone. And he gives these warnings after warning after warning. And in this case, specifically, do not multiply wives. If you take a king, he shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. And Solomon had 1,000, by the way. I mentioned that already. And let's see. When did in Solomon's life did his downfall come? Well, 1 Kings 11, the very next verse, verse 4 now. When Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods. So sad I don't know if you're like this, but sometimes I read these stories and I think, what if Solomon hadn't done that? What would his story have looked like? What would have happened to the nation of Israel? What if he hadn't done that? He had all the wisdom. He had everything that a person could ask for. And then he disobeyed God in this one major area. I'm sure he wasn't perfect. I'm sure he sinned in other areas. But he disobeyed God. And this really brought about his ruin. In fact, there was only one reason God didn't remove him right then from being king. What was it? Specifically, what was the one specific reason God did not remove him from being king right then? He threatened, he told him, he said, God told him, I am going to take the kingdom away from you. I will leave you only one tribe, but I won't do it in your lifetime for this one reason. For the sake of your father, because of David. God was still blessing Solomon in his folly because of David. David was the godly king. Solomon had wisdom that far surpassed his father now. Riches that far, far surpassed David. But David was godly. David loved the Lord. David's love for God surpassed Solomon's. That's something that God doesn't just zap into somebody. You have to choose to love the Lord. What if Solomon had just loved the Lord more? That was idolatry. Now, before we're any harder on Solomon, what if I loved the Lord more? What if you did? What do we love more? And here's the test to kind of determine, am I struggling with idolatry? Think of something you really like in life and ask yourself this: would I be okay if God just took this away from me right now? Would I be okay? Would I fall apart? Would I go to pieces? Would I struggle, turn away from the Lord, whatever, if God took this away from me? Family, that's a big one. Career, any significant person in your life, possessions, money. What would I do if God took this away? That's the idol test. Those things that mean a great deal to you, if you were to lose them, would it destroy you? Would you be angry at God? And if there's anything like that that we would answer, oh, that would be hard for me, then we're probably already on that path of idolatry. So let's be careful and learn from Solomon. I have this saying to put up here again that we've gone over so many times. Sin will always take you further than you wanted to go, keep you longer than you wanted to stay, and cost you more than you wanted to pay. And for Solomon, the cost was huge. He lost the kingdom, ultimately. It was taken away, the majority of it. It was only because of David that God left the tribe, the one, or kind of basically one and a half tribes with Solomon, well, David's line through Solomon. And all the rest were stripped away. It cost him all of that. That's what a price. What a price he paid. And in our life, it's the same thing. If you would just turn one more passage, then we'll be done. Verses here. Or no, I have one more after that on the slide. But it's Nehemiah. If you turn to Nehemiah chapter 13. So after 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah. Nehemiah 13, last chapter of Nehemiah. And I wanted to share with you just these few verses, beginning of verse 23. This happens hundreds of years later. This is after the people have gone into exile and now they're coming back into the land. Hundreds of years later. long time after Solomon. And I want to pick it up at verse 23. This is Nehemiah rebuking the people for falling into the same sin again. In those days, verse 23, in those days I also saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. As for their children, half spoken the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. So I contended with them. Notice how aggressive Nehemiah gets toward their sin. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take of their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Verse 26, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things? Yet among the many nations there was no king like him, and he was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused even him to sin. Interesting, hundreds of years later, unfortunately, that's how he's remembered. Don't make the same mistake Solomon made. That's how he sinned. And look what happened. And Nehemiah is angry. He is aggressively angry at the people for doing the same ungodly, wicked thing. And then 1 John 5:21, the Apostle John, elderly in his latter years, probably in his mid to late 90s, is writing, and he says to his people, little children, guard yourselves from idols. What would you be upset about if God took away? Are there idols in my life? Very quickly, we're going to close in prayer very quickly. Anything that you'd like to comment on, any other tidbit, lesson, principle from Solomon or this story? Let's pray. God, we thank you for these stories and such vivid, real-life reminders of what idolatry can do. Help us, please, to grow in our love for you, to learn and be reminded daily what a good and great God you are, that you are worthy of all our worship, our devotion. Help us to live our lives for you. In Jesus' name, amen.